Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Oren Harman, who is a senior research fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute and teaches at the graduate program in science, technology, and society at Bar-Ilan University. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, but
perfect pronunciation.
Okay. His books include Evolutions and The Price of Altruism, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. He lives in Berlin and Jerusalem, and the book we're talking about today is Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Oren.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So why write about metamorphosis?
Well, I feel as if the subject chose me in a way. I didn't choose the subject. I didn't really have a choice. One evening, my wife disappeared into the shower, and when she emerged, she came back with a white plastic stick with two pink lines on it and announced that we were pregnant for the third time. She was pregnant, we were pregnant, and it was, of course, a very joyful moment. But that night, that very night, I had a dream of a childhood aquarium, dry aquarium, where I used to rear caterpillars, and as a kid kind of wake up in the middle of the night with a flashlight on my head trying to spot a beautiful blue butterfly emerge from a chrysalis. And when I was a kid, I thought, you know, I was a little scientist solving all of the great mysteries of the planet. But funnily enough, this dream recurred again and again and again and again. So I started thinking that there might be some connection between metamorphosis and the life cycle and the impending birth of our third child. And so I knew that the definition of metamorphosis, being a biologist, I knew that the definition of metamorphosis is dramatic post-embryonic development, meaning that it's about everything that happens after a creature is born. So it shouldn't have anything to do with a pregnancy. But on the other hand, you know, pregnancy kind of metaphorically feels like our version of a chrysalis. And there was some connection there that I felt needed to be explored. And then I just, you know, dove down that rabbit hole for the next 6 or 7 years to work on metamorphosis, yes.
Okay, so how common in the natural world is metamorphosis?
Really good question. So, you know, most people, when they think about metamorphosis, they think about caterpillars and butterflies, they think about tadpoles and frogs. These are kind of quaint, idiosyncratic thoughts that are often related to childhood memories. But the truth is that metamorphosis is both idiosyncratic and almost universal. So today we estimate that 3/4 of all animal species undergo some form of metamorphosis, which is really a surprising and remarkable number.
Yeah. So what counts as metamorphosis then? You know, Do you think that humans undergo metamorphosis?
Well, can I give you a few examples of that aren't a butterfly and,
sure,
and a frog?
Yeah.
So that are, you know, that everyone knows count as metamorphosis, because you asked a really excellent question. Let's take the starfish. The starfish, like any other creature, starts out life as an egg. And then it develops into a young larva, which is tiny. It's a few millimeters across and long. It's translucent. And it looks like an angel with flapping wings. It's a swimmer. It swims in the midwaters. And that's what the creature looks like when it's young. Then at a certain point, a second developmental program kicks in its tummy and begins to create the adult. And the adult looks more like a starfish. You know, it's pigmented, it has radial symmetry, it often has 5 arms, not always, but 5 arms often. And then That adult grows and grows in the stomach of its larva until it reaches the tip of the larva. And then in this sort of wonderful moment, like an immaculate conception, it detaches from the larva, and the adult falls down to the seabed and becomes a kind of benthic hunter there, a starfish, while the juvenile that gave birth to it continues flapping in the midwaters. Now, what is the relationship between these two creatures? Just to let you know, they're not interested in one another. They have no interest in one another. And if I would show you these two creatures, put them on my hand and show them to you, you would have no way of guessing that they have anything to do with one another.
Wow.
And yet, what is the relationship between them? Is the larvae the parent of the adult because it kind of gave birth to it? The answer is no. Are they siblings? The answer is no. Are they cousins? No. They're actually an identity. In other words, every cell in the body of these two very disparate looking creatures that have completely different body symmetries, live in different places, and have nothing to do with one another and no interest with one another. Every single cell has the exact same DNA, the same genome. So they are an identity, which is extremely striking.
So which one has a brain, or do either of them have a brain, or do both of them have a brain?
Both of them have, I mean, a brain is a bit of a high word to call it, but they have ganglia and they have nerve cells that, you know, direct them in their comings and goings and, you know, tell them when stuff, when they need to eat and when they need to escape and so on and so forth. But, you know, they're the same creature. They're just two manifestations of the same creature. And when you think of it in human terms, wow, it would almost be as if a teenager gave birth to its own adult version and then continued to live with it simultaneously. So imagine that in human terms. We don't even have the words in our language to wrap our heads around such a relationship.
Now, I'm guessing that this discovery that these two creatures were basically the same identity happened not, that there was a time when scientists and early biologists did not know this.
Yes.
And this was discovered at some point. And a lot of your book, Metamorphosis, actually is about that history of scientists and what they discovered and when.
Yes. So it's a very long and old history that goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks. So 2,500 years. And when you look at this history from a bird's eye view, what you see is that our relationship to change, our cultural and also our scientific relationship to change, is in the eye of the beholder. Because you asked earlier, are we metamorphic? And that's a really good question, because if it's dramatic post-embryonic development, which constitutes metamorphosis, notice off the bat how fuzzy that definition is. I mean, how dramatic does dramatic have to be to count as metamorphic? And then who gets to decide?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So when you look at the ancient Greeks, someone like Aristotle was very preoccupied with metamorphosis. And for him, the world was filled with creatures that were either perfect or imperfect. And it was kind of like the apotheosis of creation was the perfection of humans in a causal universe that one could discern, one could understand. And then there were creatures, unlike humans, say insects, that were imperfect. They were not as perfect. And so they needed to go through a second transformation in order to gain their perfection. In fact, the ancient Greeks and Aristotle among them believed that it was the male who brings the essence of the creature to conception, to fertilization. And the female only brings the matter. She's a lot less important. And
I don't know. Essence without matter really wouldn't amount to much, would it?
Here, here. I'm with you. But again, we're talking 2,500 years ago. And what Aristotle, what he claimed was, he couldn't see insects have sex. And therefore, if they didn't have sex, then there wasn't a father to give them an essence. And so they needed to go through a second transformation, which was, in he believed, a spontaneous generation in order to gain their essence without fatherhood. And it's really quite curious because Aristotle, great a philosopher as he was, also believed that females, that women females have less teeth in their mouths than men do. And from our modern distance, you'd like to sort of scream out to him, Aristotle, the great Aristotle, why didn't you just ask your wife or your mother to open their, you know, their mouths and kindly? And the answer is that social mores and cultural mores, in this case, what femaleness is about and what maleness is about, can be so strong that they can trump even what a person can think and even what they can see with their own eyes. Because curiously enough, even though he reported that he didn't see sex in insects, he actually did see sex in insects and reported that too. And so it's quite amazing, you know, the what the culture believes about essential matters can be so strong, can pull so strong on your intellect that it can blind you.
You know,
running ahead 1,000 years and 1,500 years to kind of early Christians in Europe who looked at metamorphosis and were trying, as you said, they're trying to figure out the relationship between two creatures that look nothing alike. When they looked at butterflies metamorphosing, what they saw was the transfiguration of Jesus into Christ. So for them, metamorphosis was kind of an earthly reminder that deliverance was possible for human beings. Metamorphosis had been placed on earth by the good God in order to remind good Christians that they could actually save themselves. And that's how they interpreted metamorphosis. Then going ahead in time, you know, to the Darwinian moment, suddenly, you know, Darwin taught us that creatures are changing all the time, not just in their own development, but in their lineage. They're evolving. And suddenly you could interrogate metamorphosis from a different angle altogether, an angle in which creatures were no longer static species that had been created in the eye of a god and then placed on the planet, but rather evolving creatures that were constantly reacting to their changing environments. And into the 20th and 21st century, it really becomes a very molecular story about the particular genes and hormones and pathways that play a role in flicking on metamorphosis and allowing creatures to develop.
You know, it's very interesting because my interview previous to this one was with Dr. Kevin Hoffer, author of The Disease of Belief. And part of what he's talking about is how thoughts can affect gene expression.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, you know, there's a very big field called epigenetics.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, you know, all of the molecular pathways around the genes, not the genes themselves, but around the genes, in and around the genes that play a role in the regulation of genetics and the expression of genes. And what's so interesting about that field is that those pathways around the genes are much more sensitive to the environment. Mm-hmm. And so they can bring in information from the environment, and then that information has an impact on the genes that are expressed. And so there's a, you know, it's still being debated when it comes to humans, what the meaning of epigenetics is for our development and for our evolution as a human species, as mammals. You know, we know a lot about epigenetics in C. elegans in a worm, and we know about, you know, we know about it in simpler creatures. But in humans, it could very well be that our nervous system, meaning our brains, have an impact on epigenetic systems that then have an impact on the expression of genes, for sure.
Well, one of the things that I found most interesting in that is that they said when the Human Genome Project mapped, I forget how many genes, and but they had already identified many multiples of that of proteins being produced by the genes, which they used to think there was a one-to-one correlation, and turned out there wasn't. So what was causing a specific gene to decide which one of those aminos to produce? Yeah. And you know,
in the 40s, the dogma was one gene, one enzyme. And then we discovered that, in fact, that's very far from the truth, and that there's something called alternative splicing of genes, and then there's the, you know, the second level of the RNA copying and editing, and there you can do a lot of manipulations. So, yeah, we were very surprised that we had such a small number of genes.
Yeah, yeah. What was it that were very similar to some?
Well, we're very similar to a banana, to tell you the truth. I mean, 60%. That's pretty shocking.
That is,
and
very,
of course,
shocking.
You know, of course, we're 98.5% identical to chimpanzees, but we're very close to fruit flies as well.
Wow, wow. So back to more on metamorphosis. Do all insects have a larval and pupal stage?
Not all of them. There are all kinds of different types of metamorphosis. There's holometabolist creatures and hemimetabolist creatures. So there are creatures that sort of, once the egg is fertilized and they start their lives, they are actually kind of miniature versions of the grown-up, but without wings and the sexual parts. And so they sort of look like themselves, but then they grow and they grow and they grow, and often they grow by molting. And then on the final metamorphosis, the final molt, it's a more dramatic one, mm-hmm. and they gain wings and they gain sexual parts. So I'll give you an example, which is really a beautiful one: the mayfly. You know, mayflies emerge every May in European rivers, in the hundreds and thousands and millions. They emerge so drastically and so dramatically that you can actually recognize them with the Doppler gun. They're so dense. And what's been happening is that for over 2 years, unseen by us, they've been going through metamorphoses on the riverbeds, 19 of them. And the 19th happens when they're rising in the water column and they reach the tops of the water. And there they have a metamorphosis which provides wings for the first time, and which closes their mouths. They have no mouths anymore, but they have wings. So they can emerge from the waters in order to reach a branch on the riverbank and go through their final metamorphosis, which is the metamorphosis which makes them sexual. But remember, at this stage, they have no mouth.
So they're not going to live very long.
Exactly. They have to live on the energy reserves that they have in their bodies. And so what mayflies do for about 24 hours and no more is the males kind of shoot up like NASA rockets, and then they fall down like falling leaves. And this is apparently very attractive to the females. So the females come and they mate in midair, these like midair trysts, which are really quite beautiful to look at. And once the mating has occurred, the males, again, in the tens and hundreds of thousands, fall down to the riverbank and die. And the females have one final task, which is to make it back like wounded helicopters, to make it back to the waters where little slits in their stomachs allow the fertilized eggs to fall down in the water column and start the cycle anew. So,
wow. So
it's really...
Does anyone really understand the evolutionary purpose of that?
Great question again. So we've learned a lot about, as I said, the genes and the hormones involved, so the physiology of it. But the question which remains most mysterious, and which we have all kinds of hunches and hypotheses about, but we we don't know for sure what the answer is the evolutionary question. Why does it exist? Why do creatures have to go through so much destruction and reprogramming and rebuilding in order to become their adult selves? Why has nature chosen that path? And why is it so successful? You know, 3/4 of all animal species, that there must be a good solution to that question. And in fact, one of the reasons now that, you know, sort of after the fact that I understand that I was drawn to metamorphosis is because I had written a book about the evolution of altruism. And in a way, it's a similar problem, because altruism is any behavior that provides a fitness benefit to another while incurring a fitness cost. So if you do something that, you know, reduces your fitness, but helps the fitness of someone else, you are an altruist by definition, biologically. And of course, that raises the question, wait a minute, isn't evolution a game of survival of the fittest?
Yeah.
Why would a behavior that reduces fitness evolve? Why wouldn't it be kicked out by the boot of natural selection?
I am very curious about your answer to this.
Right. So just to say, to complete the thought, metamorphosis is actually quite similar in the sense that it's extremely expensive energetically and in time and in every other way. You know, you become vulnerable when you're metamorphosing, when you're molting. It's very expensive. So why would evolution find that solution for a creature's development? When it comes to altruism, there are different answers. And the answer that Darwin gave is a very powerful one. He called it for the good of the community. So if you imagine two groups that are competing with one another, and one group is filled with altruists, and the other is filled with egoists, every man to himself. What would you say if they're in direct competition? Who would be the stronger group, in your opinion?
Well, in the short term, I think the egoists would win, and in the long term, I think the altruists would.
Well, even in a one-off battle, the altruists are going to win because everyone will be helping one another. Whereas, every man to himself in the egoistic group would not lead to any kind of cohesive battle. On the other hand, within the group, that's between the groups. Within the group, it actually makes sense to be an egoist. In other words, when everyone's charging ahead to fight the others, you take a step back and you live, another day. Now, if that characteristic of taking a step back is heritable, you will pass this on to your kids, and you see that there's a problem of stability within the altruistic group. So what we came to learn, you know, decades after Darwin, was that in fact there are conditions in evolution when natural selection sees the group as if it's an individual. In other words, where the selective pressures are very strong at the level of the group, such that a trait like altruism can evolve. And so one answer to your question is just simply group selection, that it's actually better for the group if there are more individuals who are altruistic. Another answer to your question is genetics, the genetics of relatedness, that it's something called in kind of biological terms, inclusive fitness. And what that means is that, say, bees, look at, Darwin was very interested in the social insects, where you have entire castes that forego reproduction altogether. They don't reproduce. All they do is help their sisters and help the queen. So how could that be? Their fitness is zero. And what Bill Hamilton and others showed in the 60s and 70s was that when you do the genetic calculation, actually, if you're looking at evolution from the point of view of the gene, these castes that are helping their sisters, they're highly related to them genetically. So they're actually helping the genes go into the next generation. So There's a famous story about a biologist called J.B.S. Haldane, who was once drinking beer after beer in the pub in London, and someone screamed from the other end of the pub, said, "J.B.S., would you jump into the river to save your brother?" And he said, "No, but I would jump to save two brothers and eight cousins." And that's the calculus of the selfish gene, what became known as the selfish gene. And by the way, a third reply is just what you would think of if you just thought of the problem logically, is that, you know, there's also a dynamic of, I'll help you and you'll help me. Mm. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And that over time and evolution can actually create true empathy and true altruism. So that's when it comes to altruism. When it comes to metamorphosis, as I said, it's still a mystery. One thought that we have, which is probably true, but it may not be specific enough, is that metamorphosis reduces intergenerational conflict. So if you're a caterpillar and you feed on a particular plant and only on that plant, and then you grow, and disappear into chrysalis and then emerge as a butterfly with wings, that adult butterfly will be able to fly to other pastures and eat something different entirely. And so it won't be competing with the younger version of itself.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, yeah, so that makes sense. I think a more specific answer is that in evolution, there's a trade-off between growth and differentiation. In other words, you want to be as big and as strong as you can before you turn into who you are specifically. And there's a trade-off there. And in some instances, that trade-off basically produces the solution of creating a pupa. Mm.
You know, just very randomly this morning, I was having a conversation, not about your book, nothing to do with it. And the person asked me about a homunculus,
yeah,
which I had never heard of before, and I had to go look it up. So that was the belief that there was a tiny, fully formed human being that existed either in the sperm or the egg, which
right.
would have precluded any type of human metamorphosis.
Right. That was the idea. It was called preformation. That in fact, in Adam and Eve, already from the very beginning, God had created all of the creatures in miniature form inside the eggs of their parents. And the miniature babies also had eggs, and they had miniatures in their eggs ad infinitum.
Whoa.
And so, yeah, development was a great mystery for many, many years. And what I show in the book is that really shockingly, until the 17th century, no one knew how an egg is created, and no one saw an egg. People looked for the female testicles, it was called. They were looking for the ovaries, but they called them female testicles, and they didn't find them until the 17th century. So it's quite amazing, this story. And what I show in the book is that that story of figuring out reproduction is dramatically tied to figuring out metamorphosis. They were two problems that were somehow linked to one another. So it's really quite interesting that butterflies helped give us our knowledge about how we make babies.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Orrin Harmon, author of Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. So in the book, you focus on a number of scientists and other people of renown throughout history who had something to do with what we've learned about metamorphosis. And it's interesting to me that some of these people are more known as like composers or writers or philosophers than they are as scientists. And it seems like there was more of an overlap, and even with politics. And now we're sort of all in our little silos.
Yes.
Yeah.
I yes. Found... So You asked earlier whether we count as metamorphic. And I said, you know, change is always in the eye of the beholder. So I'll give you an example from our own days. There was a case, a very sad case, of a 14-year-old kid by the name of Evan Miller, who murdered his neighbor in a trailer park in Alabama. And he was given life without parole by an Alabama court. And his lawyers then took the case and brought it before the Supreme Court of the United States. It was called Miller v. Alabama. And they sat on this case in 2012. And the lawyers brought amicus curiae from the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, to show that the brains of adolescents are just entirely different from the brains of adults. The pruning hasn't happened yet of the axons. The myelination of the axons is not where it is when you're an adult. Basically, they were arguing that biologically speaking, an adolescent boy is like a Ferrari without brakes. That they just don't have the biological apparatus that allows them to control themselves in the same way that they will when they'll grow to become adults. And therefore, that you cannot treat them legally in the same manner that you would treat an adult. And the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, decided indeed that you cannot give life without parole to a juvenile killer in the United States. And that is the law in America. And so we find ourselves appealing to our biology, even to solve, you know, ethical and moral issues, to tell us something about ourselves that we can hold on to and do something with morally and legally. And So
of course, that Supreme Court ruling only applied to offenders under the age of 18. And,
that's right.
And 18 is not a mature brain either, or 19 or 20.
That's very right.
So
yeah,
there are definitely, there are many, many people spending their life in prison without parole who really were not operating with mature brains.
Right. But then again, you know, you know, this is a moral question. It's kind of a normative question that every culture has to ask itself. Say the biology is such that these are two different creatures, almost like a caterpillar and a butterfly. What does that mean from a, you know, from the point of view of how we choose to judge the actions of these people? Does that mean that they're off the hook? Does that mean that, you know, so the argument was, well, they're not off the hook, but we have to understand as a culture that they still have a lot of growing to do. And as a culture, to make a decision, a moral decision about sort of allowing them to do that to make that growth without having their prior actions and behaviors, you know, ruin the potential that they have. So yes, you know, we've been thinking about metamorphosis for 2,500 years as scientists, as natural philosophers, but we've been preoccupied in culture, in art and music, and theater and literature and philosophy with the themes emanating from metamorphosis. And what I try to show in the book is that these two preoccupations, the scientific preoccupation with what is this? How does it work? Why does it exist? These are kind of what we would call today scientific questions. And then, you know, the preoccupation with the questions, you know, what is identity? What is selfhood? Why do we need to struggle so much in order to change? That these two preoccupations actually historically go hand in hand and have impacted and influenced one another.
Well, Oren, why don't we tell us a little bit about some of the people that you write about in here, starting right at the beginning with Maria?
Yes, well, Maria is a wonderful character. I'm so glad to have met her. Most Americans don't know her, but I was living in Germany for a chunk of the time when I was doing research on this book, working in the lab and also going to archives, and was able to visit her archives. And most kids in Germany know about Maria Sibylla Merian. She's on stamps there, and she's taught to kids in grade school. She was an artist, a 17th century artist born in Germany to a family of publishers and artists who, like many in her day, if you remember, this is the tulip craze era.
Right.
She was born in Frankfurt. Everyone was crazy about, you know, the tulips coming from Holland and not just. And they would draw. Rembrandt has these wonderful drawings of beautiful flowers. And often, if you look closely, there are also insects strewn amongst the flowers. But the insects have nothing to do with the ecology or the biology of the flowers. They were just there as embellishments. They were kind of like jewels. And drawing these flowers day after day and month after month, Maria Sibylla Merian began to notice that she was drawn much more to the insects than she was to the flowers. And so she began to rear caterpillars of moths and butterflies and became known as the insect lady when she lived in Nuremberg near the milk market. And at a certain point, it's a very really interesting biographical story. She joined a pietist sect, sort of renounced the world and all of her belongings, she and her daughter, for 7 years behind a walled castle. But she was always drawn to the beauty of nature and to exotic butterflies. You remember, in those days, the Dutch were traveling to the New World, and they colonized Suriname. And so many exotic animals and butterflies were coming back, and she caught wind of this. And some of them, you know, they crossed the walls of the Pietist sect, and she heard of them. So she decided she couldn't stay there anymore, and she moved to Amsterdam, which was sort of like the New York of those days. And moved amongst artist circles, and was an art dealer alongside painting herself. And then one day just made the decision at age 52 in the year 1699 to leave everything behind and to travel via ship with her daughter to Suriname in order to figure out the life cycle of exotic butterflies and moths. So this is very unusual, a 52-year-old woman, artists traveling to Suriname and walking in the jungles with maroon slaves, hacking in the jungle, hacking the vines and the trees to allow her to find these specimens. And she's known as the first ecologist, the mother of ecology. And amazingly, she wrote this beautiful book in 1705. It's called her Suriname book. It's 65 quarto plates of drawings of these exotic metamorphosing creatures. And it played a role both in the birth of ecology and understanding the relationship between creatures and their surroundings. So she always was very careful about painting the parasitoids and the exact plant that the larvae ate, and also the adult. This was not done before. So she made the connections, and also played a role, as I said earlier, in helping to figure out what generation was. Generation was actually a kind of umbrella term that today we know included conception, reproduction, and development. And so her work helped to unpack that very crucial concept. So I love her. She left only 18 letters behind, and they're all quite technical. So you have to do a lot of imagining in order to bring back her life, but her life is so dramatic and so wonderful. And she really had this obsession with figuring out the life cycle, which touched me personally. I felt like I was walking hand in hand.
And then, you know, you talk about a number of different scientists, but there's a lot in here about someone else who I was completely unfamiliar with, Ernst Haeckel.
Yeah, Haeckel was a romantic figure. He was the most important Darwinist of his age after Darwin. And in fact, more people learned about Darwin and the Origin of Species from the books written by Haeckel than they did from Darwin himself. In the book, I talk about a great love that he had. His married a woman, they were madly in love, and then tragically she died. And he sort of went looking for her spirit in marine creatures and all kinds of medusa and cnidarians and tiny single-celled radiolarians, and made amazing discoveries. One of them was to connect the development of a creature from birth to, you know, through adolescence and adulthood and so forth to the evolution of its lineage. And he was the one who was responsible for that idea, the idea called the biogenetic law, which goes, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Want to translate that for us?
It's a mouthful. But basically what it means is that in our own, us humans, in our own development, from the moment that we start developing as a fetus in our mother's wombs, we go through the stages of the development of our species. So at one point we're a fish, and then we become a duck, and then we become a pig, and then we become a monkey. And it sounds very funny and laughable, and the biogenetic law is not a law. We actually know today that it's not 100% true, but there is some truth in it. And that truth also is a truth that allows us to understand ourselves better and to understand metamorphosis better.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the figures in the book that I was really surprised to find out had anything to do with metamorphosis was Sigmund Freud, who, when he was very young in the end of the 19th century, spent a summer in Italy, in the Mediterranean, looking for the testicles of eels.
Why?
He spent an entire number of months every morning opening up the bellies of eels and looking for testicles, because no one had seen an eel have sex. And no one knew how eels had sex. And this was a mystery that went all the way back to the ancients. There was, you know, there was a bishop who believed that eels reproduce by rubbing themselves against rocks. And then there was another man who published an hypothesis in the pages of the Royal Society, saying that they were that the sun actually fertilized the eggs of eels on thatched roofs. So no one knew, and it was a great mystery. And
wait, how did the eels get onto the thatched roofs?
Well, sometimes they jump. They're amazing creatures. They're very serpentine and strong. Aquila. But what was discovered in the end was there were these tiny specks of life that were discovered by an Italian by the name of Carassi. And what he saw was that they have 115 vertebrae. And so he went looking for other creatures in the ocean that have 115 vertebrae. And he came across the European eel, Aquila, which looks nothing like a speck of life. It looks like a very ferocious snake. And so how did this little creature turn into that gigantic creature? That started off a mystery that was finally solved by a Dane who almost went crazy trying to figure this out. And he traced back the birth of the eel to the Saragossa Sea in the North Atlantic. So they're born tiny, tiny, tiny slivers. And then over 3 years, they migrate 5,000 kilometers to the mouths of European rivers. And then they undergo a metamorphosis that turns them into something that looks like a worm that the Spaniards love to eat. And then they, against the current, they swim up the rivers until they find a den. They're very territorial. And there they can live for 50 years, turning into these serpentine hunters. And at a certain point, it's time to have babies again. And so they go back with the rivers into the Atlantic. And just before they reach the Atlantic, they go through their final metamorphosis. They lose their mouths once again, like the mayfly. their eyes become crystalline so that they could make the journey underwater, sometimes a mile underwater, tens of miles every day. Their entire innards change, and they make it back to where they were born, 5,000 kilometers.
Whoa.
But no one has actually seen them have sex. And so he failed. Sigmund Freud failed. And there's a letter that he writes to his friend from that summer saying, you know, I wish these eels left diaries, but they didn't. So we don't know their story. And the line is that he went on to study less slippery subjects with considerably more success.
Oren, why don't you read for us from Metamorphosis?
Sure, thank you so much. For me, it began with a very hungry caterpillar. My mother would turn its thick pages ever so slowly, seducing my imagination. What will come next? It seemed like make-believe. This turning into that? It made no sense. Later, like many other kids, I kept a pet caterpillar of my own, diligently feeding it with plants and watching it grow. One morning, sure enough, it disappeared into a golden chrysalis. Holding my breath, I'd stay awake into the small hours of the night with a flashlight strapped to my forehead and a little black notebook to scribble down observations. A sparkling blue butterfly appeared one afternoon, casually perched on a leaf, as if nothing special had happened. But my heart was racing. The tips of my ears went warm, and I laughed uncontrollably with the purest feeling of joy. 40 years passed. I traveled, wrote books, fell in love, became a parent. On special nights, my mother would read The Very Hungry Caterpillar to my own two little kids. Then one morning, a good number of years after my second child's birth, my wife emerged from the shower holding a white stick with two pink lines on it. And suddenly, night after night, the blue butterfly from my childhood aquarium came back to me in my dreams. Whether or not you've had kids before, to become a parent in late middle age is special. It makes you newly aware of the so-called cycle of life. More and more, I began to feel that it was getting hard to separate my personal and professional lives. I had spent a career thinking about the ideas of Charles Darwin, and the first thing my teachers taught me was that with no foresight or plan of action, life drifts like a speck of pollen in the wind. And yet every life form has a beginning, an end, and a middle. An acorn becomes an oak tree, a tiny tadpole, a leaping frog. Are our human lives also a kind of unfurling, a kind of working out of a preordained path? An amalgam of two Greek words, metamorphosis means transformation or transforming. But the biological definition of metamorphosis, radical post-embryonic development, is actually arbitrary, a matter of convention. How radical does change have to be considered metamorphic? And who gets to decide? We may not turn from caterpillars into butterflies, but most of us would agree that we undergo pretty dramatic post-embryonic development. Creatures are said to be either metamorphic or not, but in reality, they lie on a continuum. Having evolved from an ancient progenitor of jellyfish, in our own special way, we humans too metamorphose. There was little chance of us not noticing. Moons sliver, seeds sprout, empires rise and crumble. Everything in the world around us, including our bodies, is in flux. And yet, as witnesses to change, we have been and remain ambivalent. We cheer the flowering bud, but mourn the rotting fruit. We search for our younger selves and mirrors while praising the wisdom that comes with wrinkles. Carried by hopes and shackled by memories, we struggle to live in the moment. Perhaps this is why in so many cultures, we've imagined ourselves with the following metaphors: earth molded and remolded, flowing rivers, passing shadows, falling leaves. Many things change us, ideas, travels, dreams, but nothing more than the people who depart from us and the ones we bring to life.
And that was Orrin Harmon reading from Metamorphosis. Thank you. So you mentioned that you worked on this book for 6 to 7 years?
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, you were doing other work at the same time because you are a professor. And do you do other types of research as well?
I do, but actually with this project, what spun off from this project was a children's book series called the Becoming series, which I've been working on this year. And these are picture books for 3 to 5 year olds. And there'll be about 8 of them. And the heroes of each book, the books are very short. They're about 500 words long. They're to be read by parents to their kids. But each of the books will have a metamorphosing hero. So Benny Butterfly, Alex Axolotl, Stella Sea Squirt, Francis Frog. And the last one in the series will be Hannah Human, because I actually do believe that we metamorphose in our own way, even though we don't count as metamorphic. And the idea is that each one of the metamorphoses is biologically distinct. And so each one also raises a philosophically distinct question. And the challenge is to make that question relevant to a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old. And so I've been working on that with a wonderful illustrator who just won a big international prize, and she's just fantastic. And actually, the first one is coming out just on Sunday here in Israel in Hebrew.
Oh, wow.
It's the Hebrew version of Francis Frog.
Well, congratulations. That must be kind of a departure from your day job in, you know, writing a children's book.
Yes, but the more I delve into parenthood, which is just a wonderful joy, the more I'm drawn to write for children. And I actually, a few years ago, I wrote a book about the disappearance of Darwin's notebooks from the library in Cambridge. It's a true story, but I made it into a fictional whodunit to teach kids about evolution, but also to give them a good whodunit to figure out the mystery of who actually snatched those notebooks from the library.
Has it ever been solved?
It hasn't. You know, the two notebooks, the B and C notebook, were returned in sort of this fancy pink box outside of the door of the chief librarian of the Cambridge University Library. And it came with a little note, a typed note with an old typewriter that said, "Librarian, Happy Easter, X." And no one ever solved it. They were gone for 20 years.
Wow.
They returned in mint perfect condition, but they were placed exactly in the area where there's no CCTV. And so no one until this day has figured out who actually took them.
Oh, how interesting. So you mentioned in your reading the axolotl.
Yes.
That is a creature that I was unfamiliar with until a year or two ago. And my company, we had opened a plant in Mexico. So we have a whole Mexico team there. And we try and do cultural events and across all of our countries where we are. And so one year we had a company t-shirt design contest, and one of our Mexican employees submitted an axolotl design, which won the contest. So I have an axolotl t-shirt. And but tell us a little bit about them.
Well, first of all, axolotls are all the rage these days. They're everywhere. Now that we've said it, go look out and you'll find them everywhere, in cartoons and, you know, in books and TV shows, stuffed animals. Axolotls are incredible. They're basically nature's version of Peter Pan.
And the axolotls that live in lakes in the highlands of Mexico are amazing because they actually don't undergo their final metamorphosis. They reach adulthood with juvenile traits. And in this case, these frilly outer lungs, they're basically gills that make them look like tiny little dragons. Now, had they gone through their final metamorphosis, these gills would have been sucked inwards and they would have created lungs just like yours and mine. But they don't do that. And for that reason, they have all kinds of superpowers, in particular, regenerative superpowers. So they can easily regenerate a limb that's, you know, hurt or cut off, but they can also regenerate parts of their hearts and of their brains. And so we study them in order to find secrets, the secrets of youth that might be useful to us and keep us all young, keep us all Peter Pans. They're wonderful creatures.
How long will they live? Well, if they're able to constantly regenerate?
Well, they can live for tens of years and in the lab for even more than that. In the lab, you can induce them to undergo their final metamorphosis. And when you do that, they actually lose some of their magic powers.
Wow.
So it pays to stay young, to be sexually active as actually, you know, while retaining juvenile traits.
Wow. It's just amazing the variety of natural expression. It's
one of my favorite authors is John Steinbeck. And in that book, The Log from the Sea of Cortez from 1951, he has a wonderful quote. He says that the greatest danger of the speculative biologist is analogy. But actually that parallels can be amusing when it comes to the animals that you're comparing yourself to, and downright valuable when it comes to us humans. In other words, there's this plethora of examples of change and transformation in nature. And we do science, obviously, you know, to make better drugs, to make better electronics, more efficient electronics, better agriculture. We do science to find what we call truth, but we also do science to encounter metaphors in nature and in the universe that help us explain ourselves to ourselves. And one of the themes, the kind of the underlying theme of this book is that by looking at all of the wonderful examples of change in nature, we can learn something about ourselves and inform our own relationship to change in our lives. I think it's we're one of many millions of species on this planet. We're all connected on a tree of life. And while we have hoped to separate ourselves from the rest, it's actually a good idea to remember that we're all on the same tree.
Well, thank you, Oren. And that's a great way to close today because we're out of time. I always close with a quote, and I picked out one from someone else that you wrote about in the book, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Human life runs its course in the metamorphosis between receiving and giving.
Beautiful.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much, Monica. It's been a pleasure.